Hello, I am Salvador Dalí, and I am the world's best known surrealist. That my work was highly unoriginal and derivative is of no concern. That I was known to sympathize with fascists, including the Spanish government of General Francisco Franco, is of no concern. That most other surrealists were intensely angry with me for this, going so far as to expel me from the Surrealist International, is of no concern. That many of my former colleagues died in obscurity and poverty is of no concern. That I am filthy rich and showered with praise during my lifetime, that is my concern. Oh, look, here come some of my old colleagues. André Breton, Benjamin Perret, Claude Cahun, and Aimé and Suzanne Césaire. I wonder what they might want. André, Suzanne, Claude, bonjour! Stop it! Stop! No! Aiutame! Aiutame! Put down my ocelot! No! No!
Locust Radio.
Welcome to Locust Radio, a podcast about art, literature, politics, and the radical weird. My name is Alex.
I'm Tish.
I'm Adam. And this is a monthly podcast from the Locust Arts and Letters Collective. We also publish Locust Review. Please visit us at locustreview.com.
And don't forget to subscribe at patreon.com/locustreview. You can also find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook.
Just a few announcements, as always. Our fourth issue has started to hit mailboxes, so that means we're open for submissions for our fifth issue.
We'll be putting some more information about that in our show notes, but if you have something that you think is suitable for us, please send it to locust.review@gmail.com.
We're also going to be sending out the first issue of our theoretical journal, Imago, out around the same time as issue 5, around midsummer. So again, if you want a copy, make sure you subscribe at patreon.com/locustreview. Also, I want to make it clear, it's a journal of theory, not a theoretical journal in the abstract sense that it doesn't exist.
But it can be both. I mean, it doesn't exist quite yet, so.
But it's coming together. We've got a lot of pieces in. And we've started working on the design, so it's going to be ready.
Absolutely. I'm really excited for it.
It's already both a theory and practice journal then.
Yes, very true. Cool. Yeah, I'm really excited about it. So for this month's show, we are going to be just discussing surrealism. Its history, mostly, and its theory and practice. We've referenced before on the show that we wanted to talk about the kind of raw materials or the different artistic movements and radical and political movements that sort of comprise what we call critical irrealism, the radical weird, so on and so forth. And surrealism is kind of a ground zero for that. You could say maybe in that it's probably the earliest time when you can really, it becomes very clear what critical irrealism is. That vein of it is very clear in surrealism. You could also maybe argue the same thing about Russian futurism or Dada or things like that, but we nonetheless thought we'd talk about surrealism because that kind of... It's where a lot of people have a really strong reference point for that. Most people can have some conception of what surrealism is. Like when people talk about, oh, this is so surreal or whatever, that's sort of what they're saying. And unfortunately, the most recognized surrealist in the world is... person we heard from earlier, someone who, you know, we gotta pour one out for our poor friend Salvador.
Well, it's Salvador had it coming. I mean, like, when he got beat up and his ocelot got taken away from him. I mean, not only were there, like, his 1930s flirtations, right, with Hitler and Nazis. What do you say? Hitler turned me on in the highest. And I often dreamed of Hitler as a woman. His flesh, which I imagined as whiter than white, ravished me. And then, of course, the Franco shit. He had it coming.
Yeah, he did.
He absolutely did. Yeah.
I mean, he made one of the greatest surrealist films of all time, Es un Shenandoah, that he did with Luis Buñuel. And my understanding is Buñuel never talked to him again because of the Franco shit. Like,
Well, and Buñuel was also, as most of that original, generation of surrealists, was a communist. You know, many of them would start out joining the sort of official communist party of their country, be it France or Spain or wherever. but then they would quickly move into like more dissident forms of Trotskyism or libertarian Marxism or things like that. And I think that it's kind of indicative of the very apoliticized, watered down, and nonetheless ubiquitous version of surrealism that we see all around us today. You know, like this very kind of, it kind of makes sense that the most recognized surrealist from the original generation was a fascist. In a time like this, when, you know, surrealism can be used to, you know, like I call it like Old Spice surrealism, you know, like the Old Spice commercial, just very, very, very silly, very much embracing of, you know, a kind of cockeyed alterity in it, you know, very zany and madcap. And it's fun, but it doesn't really have much substance to it. It's not really trying to critique anything. Matter of fact, it's doing the opposite of critiquing something. It's in some ways it's dulling critical faculties. I think it's one of the reasons we wanted to do this show about,
well, it's
about
always,
surrealism.
In some ways, Dali reminds me of like one of the precursors. I mean, because there's a long sort of genealogy of literary and artistic movements that helped produce surrealism. Obviously, most immediately Dada, but also the symbolists, Baudelaire and Rimbaud, and there would be like, there was this sort of contradictory aspect to that kind of romantic symbolist poetry, where on the one hand it could be very progressive, and on the other hand it could be almost fascist. And you can see this in several of Baudelaire's poems. Dali reminds me of a throwback to that. You know, like, even if he isn't a fascist, he's fine with fascism because he's this petty bourgeois ego just consuming everything around him. You know, like, I mean, I was poking around the internet looking around, you know, reminding myself of all the reasons I hate Dali. And I even felt like the George Orwell stuff about him. And of course, Orwell has his own historical problems in terms of naming names of the Communist Party to the British government after World War II. But he called Dali a disgusting human being. And of course, Orwell, at his best, fought in the Poom militia against the fascists in Spain. So he had no time for Dali, although he thought he was a good draftsman, you know, and so on. But the shit, like, I mean, even the, not the political stuff, like Dali kicking his sister in the head for no reason and like terrorizing women in his adulthood, and some like almost serial killer shit, or that photo op he did with the cats, where he repeatedly threw a cat 30 times, three cats, 30 times across the room to get the perfect photo of cats flying across a room. What an awful thing. But I think for like the art institutionalization of surrealism, it's very narrow. It only focuses on certain European surrealists at a certain point in history. Not all of the European surrealists, definitely not most of the surrealists outside of Europe. And it excises the political dimension of it in a big way. I think the way I put it once, to sort of reduce it to dead white guys doing weird shit in between World War I and World War II. But it's actually much more than that. And actually, while not all critical realism is surrealist, surrealism, we owe a lot to surrealism in terms of our understanding.
I knew that I didn't like Dali, although I wasn't totally sure why, if I'm honest. Like, I didn't really actually know that much about him. I was really surprised. I had no idea that he was like actually removed from the Surrealist International. And honestly, like the sense that I got after reading about him was that he was just sort of a soulless clout chaser, for lack of a better term. Like I didn't know I knew a little bit about sort of the brushes with fascism and the sort of fascination with Hitler and stuff, but I guess I didn't know like how intense that was. I was so disappointed to learn more about Dali and have it just be like, well, he came to America and became America famous, and he's the person that we all know about surrealism, and he like just doesn't embody anything about it. And I think, what was it, the quote that he had, like when he was talking about like defending against to Breton, where he said like, I don't necessarily hate the proletarian, I don't have any feelings for or against the proletariat. It's like, well, that's not fucking good.
Yeah. There's this sense of, I mean, even just going through some of the other, another little part of his another part of his biography here, which is that he was a close friend of Wallace Simpson, who is best known to history as being the divorcee that the King of Britain, God, what was it, King George something? It doesn't matter. King Edward, I think it was King Edward, who had to abdicate his throne for, because he wanted to marry her. But she also was an open admirer of Hitler, and you know, was very much comes from like an upper crust background. She and the former king, of course, lived in just like amazing wealth even after he abdicated. There's a sense where his weirdness, whatever we want to call it, is like a decadent one, and one that sees itself as outside of history. And actually, I almost see, like, you know, the way he would just, you know, glorify himself, and also, you know, his abusive behavior and things like that. You can draw a really direct through line between his kind of absurdism and the absurdism of, say, the online far right today. I think there is a very clear line that can be drawn here. And this gets us into all sorts of questions that I know that, Adam, that you in particular are taking up in your essay for Imago, about the difference between, because, you know, fascism, fascists and Marxists and left-wing revolutionaries both want to sort of, you know, disrupt things in ways that appear very similar, but actually are at complete polar opposites. And that also reflects into their approach to the weird, their approach to what the function of the surreal, the unreal, the whatever we might want to call it.
I think one of the things that's really important about surrealism, and it's very, in one sense, French and Haitian, and it has a certain Francophone aspect to it, the radical connection of liberty and equality, right? Mm-hmm. And in that way, it's that surrealism is about this, you know, it is about like the subconscious and all this stuff. It's influenced by Freud for good and bad, as well as by radical socialist politics. But because it's both about equality and liberty, it's very different than something that's just about petty bourgeois or bourgeois liberty, which is something like Dali, right?
Yeah.
It's very much like the libertarian fascist kind of current that you get in the United States, which is also somewhat different than most European fascisms. Mm-hmm. But because of this liberty and equality thing, and the idea that individuals actually have value in terms of their self-expression in surrealism, you get what I talk about, like in the article you were talking about, is for our side is a contingent and evolving and multiple mythology, right? That is represented in surrealism, but several other realist traditions. I like that, you know, like A.V. Ludacharsky's concept of God building, where he talks about the space that used to be given to organized religion and so on, and turning that into a democratic anarchic space that is in a evolutionary process of becoming like the class struggle itself. And I think that, you know, the way Michel Loewy talked about it was myth in perpetual motion, always incomplete and always open to the creation of new mythological figures and images. This incompleteness of evolving nature is totally due to this democratic aspect of liberty. Like, mm-hmm. I get to express myself, and it's all worthwhile. You know, like, there's, like, the Aimé César quote where he says, and Aimé César being one of the important Afro-surrealists of the 20th century from... the Caribbean, he says, to make a world emerge where the exotic inhumanity of junk shop was displayed, where we were only drawing forth the vision of the grotesque puppets, gathering a new way to suffer, die, come reined in a word, to bear a certain human load. And then Juan Brea, another Afro-surrealist, saying, in the final analysis, the concept of quality is nothing but the divination of human behavior at the expense of the broad dehumanization of other behaviors. Yeah. So everybody gets to build a world. All worlds are actually worthy. And, you know, or as André Masson put it, surrealism is the collective experience of individualism. You know, mm-hmm. So if it's an individual experience of individualism, it might not be fascist, but it's not surrealist. It's at the very minimum Betty Bourgeois in some fashion.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, so maybe we should start kind of at the beginning here. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about who the surrealists were, how they formed, and what their ideas were, just sort of right out of the gate. I mean... You know, really what we're talking, if we want to talk about the quote-unquote official founding of surrealism, and it's interesting to me that the surrealists, they founded them, they perceived it, conceived of themselves as an international, the Surrealist International, like that was deliberate and wanted it to run alongside the Communist International or the Fourth International. Like, that's one of the important things to say right out of the gate, is that it's not just... an artistic movement. And this connects with what you were saying, Adam, that this isn't just about, you know, as you say, old, dead white dudes doing weird shit in between the wars. It was about a rejection of a type of rationality that they had seen completely grind down countless human beings, hundreds of thousands of human beings in the First World War. You know, the First World War was in some ways like the first modern war, the first industrial mass imperial conflict. And so you have, you know, hundreds or thousands of young men, you know, suffocating on mustard gas in the trenches. Just the amount of carnage that capitalist rationality, the parsing of life into its most measurable and logical segments and increments, that's where they had seen that's exactly where that had all resulted in. Or what that had all resulted in, just this mass carnage, this mass slaughter. So for them, there was this sense of rejecting this very teleological, linear way of looking at the world, of history, at creativity, and at human agency. And that applied to art, certainly it applied to poetry, it applied to literature, but I think most of all, they saw that art and literature in service of something, as you said, this type of liberty and equality that at the time made the most sense to be under, you know, a broad libertarian Marxist banner. This one of the things that Michael Lovey says, and this was one of the texts we read for today, I think the way that he just sort of puts it is really, this is just in Breaking Out of the Steel Cage in chapter one in Morning Star, he says, "Surrealism is not, has never been, and will never be a literary or artistic school, but is a movement of the human spirit in revolt, and an eminently subversive attempt to re-enchant the world, an attempt to re-establish the enchanted dimension at the core of human existence. Poetry, passion, mad love, imagination, magic, myth, the marvelous, dreams, revolt, utopian ideals, which have been eradicated by this civilization and its values. In other words, surrealism is a protest against narrow-minded rationality, the commercialization of life, petty thinking, and the boring realism of our money-dominated industrial life. It is also the utopian and revolutionary aspiration to transform life, an adventure that is at once intellectual and passionate, political and magical, poetic and dreamlike. It began in 1924. It continues today. So what happened in 1924?
Well, the first Surrealist Manifesto was published.
Yep.
People should know Breton worked with, shell-shocked, otherwise PTSD-afflicted troops during World War One. He was influenced by Dada, but broke from its sort of, there's a rejection of bourgeois norms and rationality in both Dada and Surrealism, but there's also a nihilistic streak in Dada, because it was sort of a clearinghouse for everybody who thought World War One was just insane, right? And also a clearinghouse for, like, radical impulses that had built up an art around mechanical reproduction, randomness, and things like that. And then Breton ties this. Of course, Breton, in addition to publishing the Surrealist Manifestos, I believe it's the second manifesto that states an open alliance with communism, ran an art gallery in Paris that featured many of the Surrealist painters we know to get today. And published a series of journals and subsidized other journals that dealt with Surrealism, including Afro-socialist journals later outside of France. But I think that the key, and it's somewhat hard to, like, you know, parse through the manifestos because they're very much written in this Surrealist method, right? Of stream of consciousness and so on, and not second guessing yourself and things like that. In fact, there's a whole passage in one of the manifestos where Breton says, "I don't like what I just wrote, but I can't revise it because that would betray everything." You know, but I think that one of the interesting things about Breton, they're interested in things like alchemy, the Surrealists, and esotericism and things like that, mesmerism. And other things. And Breton, he's like, one of the things he's doing in his poetry, because what he does is, in addition to the theory of Surrealism, is write poetry, is, you know, and people have talked about it, seemingly putting random things together, poses questions about the causal relationship between those things, relationships that are often denied by the sort of empiricism of bourgeois ideology. And it's like you were saying, Alex, the Surrealists railed against rationality because rationality within capitalism tends to be a realistic fidelity to ideology in the Marxist sense. Capitalism's common sense meta-narrative about itself. This is something Breton talks about, you know, rationality is next month's budget sheets and everything else, things that aren't really right. It's, you know, whatever. So Surrealism, rooted in Dada's rejection of World War One, also symbolism, psychological imagery, like Rimbaud's notion of otherness within the self, which is something I think the Surrealists have wanted to weaponize sort of as an internal counter narrative to that ideological meta narrative of false rationality. And they did this in a couple of really interesting ways. One is the construction of dream images, right? Through semi-traditional methods of art, film, literature, as you see in Lucien Andelot or most of Bunuel's films or many of the paintings, but also automatism, automatic drawing, painting, and writing, where you just, it's not as if you're just letting things flow from yourself. It's still mediated, which is part of the question, which is, this is where it's a direct influence from 19th century ideas of mesmerism. And this had a huge influence after the war on American painters, in particular the abstract expressionists. But it also percolates in other areas and things like what Amira Baraka described as Afro-surreal expressionism. But this is what I want to stop talking for a second. The otherness within the self, what creates this? And this is something we could talk about a lot. And this isn't necessarily something that's sussed out in the early Surrealist stuff, but every working class person has a conflict of consciousness, right? Between capitalist ideology and class consciousness, two selves. And this is, and of course, class consciousness ultimately leads to totally free consciousness. And this is compounded even more so for, like, and in some ways made clearer by people who are further oppressed, and in the ideas of black artists and thinkers who have examined what Du Bois called double consciousness, right? Yeah, there's a similarly pronounced example of people who lived in totalitarian dictatorships where you have, like, the kitchen consciousness or the kitchen persona, where you're mostly yourself, and then the persona you have when you're out in the world. And Rochelle Spencer talks a lot about this in her book on Afro-Surrealism. So I don't want to keep going, but I think that this starts to, because while the Surrealists are this great rebellion, Bertrand doesn't necessarily synthesize how this happens, right? How is it that you have a free self and an unfree self? You know, is it just rationality abstractly? Eventually, the Surrealists move away from an Orientalist understanding of non-Western art, but at the beginning, like all modernists in Europe, they do share an Orientalist idea of non-Western art. They make it a positive thing. This is farther away from the bullshit rationality of Europe, but that is a real othering and a detachment of what these cultural products that came from outside of Europe actually mean, especially ones that came from developed class societies, and so on. So I think that aspect of, like, how do you, this, that the class, the contradiction of consciousness is in our heads as well as in the streets, is like one of the insights that comes not necessarily immediately at it, but comes from it in the long term. And that's true of consciousness and other forms of oppression and so on.
When I think of, like, the Surrealists that have really had a massive impact on me, Breton's poetry is interesting, but it kind of leaves me cold, is the thing. And I think that's indicative of the fact that he is only just starting to realize something, like sort of the contours of the crack in the edifice of capitalism. And he draws some of the right conclusions from that, like, that we need, as a result, we need a communist revolution, we need to be anti-imperialist. But it seems to be folks like Benjamin Perret and a lot of those other folks who really seem to, like, inject some real soul, for lack of a better term, into the Surrealist mandate. And I think that really kind of takes off, especially when we start to talk about Surrealism in the Caribbean and colonial context. Certainly in the African continent, in the Egyptian Surrealists, who I think that the Egyptian group was, I think, the only part of the Surrealist International that was able to survive World War II, which is interesting. But also we've already mentioned them, Suzanne and Aimé Césaire, you have Pierre Yoyot, Ted Jones, folks like that, and then who go on to really impact people like the Black Arts Movement in the U.S., for example, Amiri Baraka, so on and so forth. And it seems like that, like you said, that Adam, at least in the beginning, they're sort of the sort of core group of Surrealists are kind of grasping at straws, like something is wrong here. Something is very, very wrong and we know that it leads to radical left-wing conclusions. But it takes a little while, it seems like, for Surrealism to sort of find its groove and really, really mine the subconscious and talk about the freedom of the individual and sort of fractured nature of the individual with any kind of success. And I think the thing that's ironic about that is that I think it feels like they only reach that point when they have a really clear nemesis to talk about. Because when you talk about capitalism and empire, it's one thing. When you talk about fascism, it's another entirely. And it seems like that's when Surrealism starts to really take on, like, its synthesis between the artistic and creative and the political and the transformational starts to really take off around that time. And I think this is one of the reasons why the current discussion around, like, Black anti-fascism that is starting to force the current left to kind of reassess its understanding of fascism, whereas before it's just been like Trotsky, 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 and now, you know, we can talk about folks like, you know, that, oh, actually the Panthers, Angela Davis, and, you know, certainly the Caribbean anti-fascists had a sense of, you know, Aimé Césaire's quote that, you know, that what the Nazis were able to do, they were only able to do because it had been perfected on in colonial regions. That's something that I think we're starting to come to grips with now. And that partly has to do with the insight that Surrealism provides about the sort of way that it front loads liberty and equality at the same time and creative autonomy.
Well, I'm reminded what we were talking about, the whole idea of the missed encounter between Adorno and Fanon, right? The fascism stuff clarifies it, but of course, the elements that ended up making up, you know, European fascism at the midnight of the last century, of course, as has been talked about by multiple people, were used repeatedly during imperialism and colonialism. But there's also, you know, and so that stuff is brought to the forefront for the Afro-Surrealists and Surrealists in colonized nations in a way it wasn't for Breton and so on. But there's also the class background of Breton, you know, like, like when you start to see like the exploitation and oppression in this dialectical relationship with the idea of a free imaginary, you start to like, it starts to have the kind of soul and weight. There's Ibn Cesar's Journal of a Homecoming, there's this little excerpt, which I think is a wonderful discussion of the contradiction in consciousness central to Marxism, the class in itself and the class for itself, but in this a surreal manner. He writes, "In this inert town, this strange crowd that does not congregate, does not mingle, adept at finding the moment of disengagement, of escape, of evasion, this crowd that does not know how to behave like a crowd, this crowd, you understand, that is so completely alone under the sun, like a woman you would have thought to be wholly in tune with her lyric cadence, who brusquely calls out to hypothetical rain and commands it not to fall. Or like one who makes a rapid sign of the cross without apparent motive, or like the unexpectedly stark animality of a peasant woman urinating upright, legs far apart and stiff." And so when you take the free imagination in this dialectical interrelationship with the lived experience, with the phenomenological experience of the exploited and oppressed, it takes on an additional weight. There's something really interesting, because when you were talking, I was thinking of this thing I read in the Afro-Surreal Manifesto that was published in 2013 in Black Camera, Journal Black Camera, by D. Scott Miller. And he cites that famous quote from Frida Kahlo that, "I'm not a surrealist, I just paint what I see." And this, of course, has caused a conundrum for lots of art historians and curators who, of course, want to include Kahlo in their surveys of the movement for good and bad reasons. The good reasons being Kahlo is a wonderful painter and so on. Maybe the bad reasons being like they don't want to bother familiarizing themselves with the dozens of women who are artists who actively identified as surrealist. And what Miller extrapolates from this is the idea that subjects denied, I'm paraphrasing and using my own terminology, subjects denied normative status under a racist and imperialist ideology already experienced reality, which is for the most part capitalist ideology's idea about itself as surreal. And I think this is evidently true. And I think this normative disjuncture with reality repeats in various ways across all identities and categories of the oppressed and exploited, with, of course, important differences, specification, intensities, partial inclusions or disinclusions, and so on. But, like, I was thinking, what is it, if not surreal, for, like, a working-class single mom on her way home from work who looks out her car window and sees a billboard of a lavish feast hovering above the ruins of an abandoned factory? The only thing that doesn't make it surreal is the normative conditioning of ideology. But this is, you know, this feast floating up there above a ruin is itself a psychological physical eradication, I mean, of the line between dreaming and waking life. A working woman's hunger is then projected above this collapsed history. And I think this sort of thing is true for all exploited and oppressed persons who would encounter this. But the intensity of the dislocation and refracted experience is multiplied even more so and more greatly for people of color, especially in the United States for Black and Native persons. Imagine, you have the hunger magically projected above this ruin, but your hunger is denied its human quality. It's accompanied by denial of it. So when Frida Kahlo says she's not a surrealist, right? Obviously, we have to take her at her word because we believe in self-determination. But in her painting, The Wounded Deer, in which, you know, you have that deer with Frida's face and she's shot with arrows like Saint Sebastian running through a forest, we see also a dream life manifest, I think, as protest.
Yeah, I kind of liked that quote. There was something about that that stuck with me the first time I heard it. Because, like, I kind of got it as a creative person. Like, I'm not in the box you want to put me in. I just do the thing that I see and I feel, and I make the things that I see and I feel. I kind of like that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And when I think about my own sort of artistic and political evolution and the moments where the two fit together in a way that was organic, that I wasn't forcing, Kahlo's work certainly was a big part of that. And I mean, I'll come honest by it, also a lot of it had to do with the movie Frida, which I think, and of course after that I started to, you know, do research and actually read more about her and her ideas, right. And you know, more familiarize myself with the work, quite apart from the sort of Hollywood version of it.
Right.
Nonetheless, I think that's actually a fairly underrated movie. And I think if you're going to get an introduction to the creative politics, if you will, of Frida Kahlo, you could do a lot worse than to start with that. So it's interesting because, yeah, what that quote really does, it problematizes what this, I guess, what I keep calling the surrealist mandate, but it does so in a way that is, well, there's a way to problematize a question in a way that where it just becomes impossible. This problematizes it in a good way for all the reasons that Adam and Tish spoke about. Yeah, because we do have, and I think this is one of the things I'd like to get to at a certain point where we talk about, okay, what is surrealism today in this time when the absurd is already so much all around us, but it's very much arranged in a way that's concomitant with what capitalist ideology expects from us. So therefore, how do you start to look at it? You know, maybe it becomes like the putting on the glasses in John Carpenter's They Live. All of a sudden, everything is still where it is, but it's situated differently, and you see it for its actual function. The question to me also becomes like, how did surrealism seek to kind of weaponize that disjuncture? And I think this is one of those moments where, again, the artistic and creative starts to pass over into the political, in a way that isn't forced, that is truly organic, that is about trying to figure out that disjuncture in a way that we can actually point to it and use it and liberate it even. And that's one of the reasons why I think that, you know, coming, I think there's a reason why left-wing aesthetes always come back to the Manifesto for an Independent Revolutionary Art in 19, what was it, 38 when it came out. You know, it was written, yeah, it was signed by André Breton and Rivera, but most likely the Trotsky had a lot of authorship, or at least some critical feedback, or some useful feedback in it.
Yeah, usually people think Breton and Trotsky wrote it, and there was time. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah. And in some ways, the lack of not knowing the authorship of it makes it even more powerful, I think. But
it's got more, you know, aura in a Benjaminian sense.
Yeah, in a Benjaminian sense, and I think that. Because it becomes sort of like a faceless sort of mandate for it. And I think of this in terms about, like, I think we forget actually how significant it was that the Surrealists were so excited by psychoanalysis, because actually, even in the Marxist, actually in some ways, especially in the Marxist and Communist movement, psychoanalysis and psychology, Freud, all of that, were very much dismissed. Meanwhile, the Surrealists very much embraced it so that we could understand the types of things that Adam and Tish, both of you, just spoke about. And I think, this gets back to what I was talking about earlier, the sort of weaponization of that fracture in our consciousness, and using that as sort of an entree into actual full-class consciousness, the abolition of work, a free and equal society where everyone is able to build the world that they want to, and that also fits into all that, you know, this multiverse that all, where it all fits, all of our worlds fit together. And I keep coming back to, when I was rereading the manifesto right now, in preparation for this today, this paragraph stuck out to me, and this is in relation to the psychoanalysis stuff that I was talking about. The communist revolution is not afraid of art. It realizes that the role of the artist in a decadent capitalist society is determined by the conflict between the individual and various social forms which are hostile to him. We would say them, but they were, you know, back in the 30s. This fact alone, insofar as he is conscious of it, makes the artist the natural ally of revolution. The process of sublimation, which here comes into play and which psychoanalysis has analyzed, tries to restore the broken equilibrium between the integral ego and the outside elements it rejects. This restoration works to the advantage of the ideal self, which marshals against the unbearable present reality all those powers of the interior world, of the id, which are common to all men, all humans, and which are constantly flowering and developing. The need for emancipation led by the individual spirit has only to follow its natural course, to be led to mingle its stream with this primeval necessity, the need for the emancipation of man. And that really sticks out to me, because I think without the sort of a psychoanalytic dimension a psychological dimension, we don't really understand the working class as it is in an individual sense, or in what you've referred to, Adam, as the differentiated totality, or what Césaire referred to as the crowd. You know, a crowd that is made up of individuals who have their each with their own wants and needs, but haven't figured out a way to put all of those wants and needs on the same wavelength yet. To me, that's really that's one of the things that makes the surrealists so important, is they illustrate quite literally through their art the role of psychology in class struggle, the role of psychology in fighting for a fully emancipated world. And that's one of the reasons that I think that it's really, I think looking at it in that way also opens up what we begun the conversation with, which is that there is, that we can't just look at surrealism as just an artistic movement, and that it is, or simply a European movement, or a movement mostly of white men. I mean, you know, like, there were plenty of sexists and misogynists among the men who made up the surrealist movement, but then you also had people like Leonora Carrington, who were able to create, in some cases, some of the most amazing surrealist novels. You know, you have Frida Kahlo, of course. You have Remedios Varo. And I think in some ways, some of the worlds that they create are so incredible in that respect, because they show this sort of multivalent way in which that the fracturing of our psychology goes in, especially when it comes to matters of race and of gender and of sexuality.
You know, to kind of like add on to that a little bit, just while you mentioned psychology and stuff, like, there, I was thinking as I was reading about surrealism and stuff, and the process of like automatic writing and stuff, like, there's something just really cathartic, even if it never turns into anything as a writer or a creative person, even not a writer or a creative person, to just sort of like let your mind go and make things up. Like, that's a really like important and cathartic and incredible thing, I think, that, and maybe it's just because it's been coming up a lot for me, because, you know, pandemic, anxiety, lack of ability to write, like, sometimes just sitting down and like making whatever comes into my mind makes me feel a lot better, and then I can go and make the real thing.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I find the same thing when I sit down and write. I know, Adam, it's the same for you. There is something about art that kind of does have a consequence. I don't want to say make us okay with the outside world, but it at least puts our mind in such a state where we can look at it for what it is and find a way forward.
No, absolutely. Right? Yeah, it's like it's sort of like taking the nonsense that builds up inside of you after observing and experiencing the world and making it make sense.
I think one of the reasons why Marxism has been historically at the time confused about surrealism was because of official Marxism abandonment of the idea that the central subject of Marxism is the self-emancipation of the exploited and oppressed, right? The unity of the philosophical Marx with the economic Marx, the Marx of the of alienation and the philosophical manuscripts and the Marx of capital are actually one Marx. And once you have a dictatorship ruling in the name of the working class and social democratic reformism taking the revolutionary ardor out of Marxism, other things start to become the subject. And I think that surrealism, its intense focus on both equality and subjectivity, including in all the surrealisms that have developed since its initiation, cuts against that way and confuses a Marxism that isn't focused on that. To go back to like Rochelle Spencer, who wrote the book on a recent book on Afro-surrealism, she wrote, "If we accept the premise that temporality is part of one's subjectivity, then to ignore people's conception of time is to deny their humanity," right? Mm. So the idea of a crude teleology of progress, already rejected by the surrealists at the beginning, is of course central to most of the realist black currents. And as we've talked about, going back to when we were at Red Wedge, but also at Locust Arts and Letters Collective, Alex and I, going back, the idea of a gothic futurist relationship to time. And when I was first looking at this, when we were first looking at it, I was looking at it through a Marxist class lens, coupled with an understanding of the dynamics around the particular oppressions of the United States, most of all. You know, the whole idea that both the future and the past are contested, right? They both have victories and defeats, and so you can't simply be nostalgic or optimistic, right? But I think the Afro-surrealists have really, and other Black and realist currents and thinkers have looked at this even more thoroughly, like mixing up time in the work. And this makes sense, of course, because white supremacy and racism located non-white, non-Western subjects as part of the past is primitive and automatically assumed white Western subjects were the future of civilization, despite all the evidence to the contrary, which you can see if you've watched Raoul Peck's great new documentary, Exterminate All the Brutes. D. Scott Miller put it like, what is the future? The future has been around so long, it is the past. And you see similar attacks on teleological assumptions in like Black Quantum Theory from Rashida Phillips and other things. And I think that one of the things this shows is the sort of pressure, as you said, Tisha, like I have this pressure too. I want to make the great thing, right? Mm-hmm. I want to like, you know, you're trained in art school to try to come up with this great idea.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons why so much contemporary art is dull is because that's not exactly possible.
Mm-hmm.
If you're trying to do it anyway. And there's actually nothing wrong with just expressing yourself. It's like the Brea quote, like, quality is a way to, denigrate everyone else's expression,
yeah.
You know? And what is actually the most beautiful is when everyone gets to express themselves.
Mm-hmm.
That's our equivalent. That's the critical realist equivalent of the Ninth Symphony, Beethoven. Or the other thing that is equal to my mind as Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, which is Fear of a Black Planet. Public Enemy. So I spent my sophomore year of high school just listening to those two albums in alternation over and over again.
The surrealist dream and the critical irrealist dream about everyone just having a chance to express themselves. Which, of course, you can't in a, you know, highly authoritarian society like the one we live in, you know, be it bureaucratic or, you know, capitalist or both, is, you know, that being the dream really hits home. And I do think also goes further to demystify what surrealism is. Robin Kelly, in his book Freedom Dreams, where he talks about the Black radical imagination, he's got a chapter on Black surrealism in there. And he starts actually by talking about how Richard Wright's Native Son was intended by Wright to be a surrealist novel. And which is interesting because actually, if you, it's one of my favorite books, though I find it very difficult to, every time I read it, it's very difficult. I can only read like, you know, 20 pages at a time until I have to like put it down, get up and just like, you know what, because it's such a like unrelenting, it's a book of such unrelenting brutality in every sense, psychological, physical, emotional, so on and so forth. It's just such a brilliant and yet difficult read for that matter. But like, it's this very gritty realism, right? Or at least it comes across like that. But the way in which everything revolves around Bigger Thomas's mind, around his mindset and his, you know, weird fractured attempt to and to gain some sort of control or autonomy over his life as a black man, and finally accepting that in a weird way he found that through murder, is actually a very surreal thing. And in some ways is being able to center that, the psychological in that is really kind of key. It almost reminds me of, you know, what Fanon says, where he says that in some ways violence is a cleansing force for the oppressed. It's a way in which they can come to grips with just how terrible, just how dehumanized the world has made them. And to embrace a certain amount of necessary violence is to reclaim one's humanity. Again, these are things that are very terrifying, but that doesn't mean they're any less necessary in understanding. And now, you know, the case of Bigger Thomas obviously is deliberately written in a very complex way by Richard Wright. But nonetheless, I think that that very much sort of points to what that surrealism is in its own way. While it rejects reality, it has an absolute allegiance to the truth as it is. And that's the truth of racism, the truth of, you know, so much else.
Some of the best surrealists, even amongst like the European surrealists of the classical period or whatever, the heyday or whatever you want to call it, do this even when they might not intentionally be trying to do it. I mean, there's like, I was talking to, because there are still people who are organized surrealists. I was talking to a surrealist friend of mine who actually is going to be copy editing all future issues of Locust Review for us. And we were talking about the obnoxious, like, automatic use of, like, naked women in surrealist collage for no fucking reason, right?
Oh, yeah.
And so there's definitely that side of things, with the Chirico paintings and so on. But did you see, like, something like... I was looking at... one of my favorite pieces is Max Ernst's collage novel, Un Semaine de Bonté, A Week of Kindness, which some academics have described as sort of a surrealist interpretation of esoteric ideas about alchemy and stuff like that, particularly after Breton was talking about alchemy, and I think it was the second surrealist manifesto. But one of the things that's interesting about Ernst's novel, which is a collage novel of collage prints and stuff from mostly the Victorian era, is it's like almost possibly accidental proto-queerness. It's like structured in reference to the various stages and elements of the alchemical process, the mythical alchemical process, and its gendering of the elements. And what's odd about it, and particularly in Ernst's use of it in his graphic novel, is that the natural state of the elements is essentially androgynous, both male and female. So at the beginning of Week of Kindness, there's an androgynous figure with a woman's body and a lion's head, and her left arm is replaced with a suited arm, and above her is a serpent, or above them is a serpent. So if the natural state of gendered material in this alchemical mythology is androgynous, the first part of the process is their separation. And Ernst depicts this as a series of violent episodes, right? So women are violently objectified, chased after, an androgynous figure is thrown from a castle wall, women and men are tied up in train cars, a man is decapitated, another one is like a man with a lion's head is walking down the country road holding a skull in his hands. And then this trauma of separated or enforced gender is, you know, like repeated throughout the book as the elements are mixed together and then separated again. And things like that. And at the end of the book, it's this sort of the end of the alchemical process, the transmutation of elements, which depending on what you're trying to do is either immortality or gold, right? And I'm not an expert in this medieval shit, but the end of his book reflects that. And some read it as sort of a reassertion of like a heterosexist sort of like point of view. But I was looking at the images, and I'm not, if that is a reassertion of a heterosexist gaze, I'm not sure Ernst is entirely happy about it. In the final pages of the book, some see an example of a search for a perfect woman. There's this woman in a glamorous pose floating above a dark street and this male figure walking nearby her. But he isn't actually looking at her or walking toward her. He seems to be going about his business, like, concealed in the shadows. And she might look glamorous, but she's a phantasm. He doesn't see her. And so the enforced separation of gender reads here like kind of like the aftermath of almost an unnecessary war.
Now,
you can read this in different ways. And obviously, Ernst is trying to say something, you know, or pivoting off of these alchemical myths or these myths of alchemy. But it points beyond the sort of like just crude, here's naked women thing you get from some of these male surrealists at the time, and raises questions that might not have even been answerable until now, or into the last 30 or 40 years. Which I think is one of the great things about some of this work, and I think that you see this in a number of critical surrealist works. It isn't that it's just about expression. There's also criticality in like a lot of the best work. And I'll stop talking, but like point out, my second favorite movie of all time is both a surrealist expression and a didactic work, and that's El Angel Exterminador, like the exterminating angel, by Luis Buñuel, in which this group of rich people get trapped by a mysterious force in a mansion in Mexico City and descend into barbarism. It's one of the most brilliant films. My favorite film of all time is, of course, The Hawks and the Sparrows by Pasolini,
which also has a great deal of surrealist elements in there. It's sort of reconstructing fairy tales or myths through, you know, a lens of, you know, dissident class consciousness, I guess you could say. The Exterminating Angel is one of my when it was first shown to me. It was by a comrade who said, I can't believe you've never seen this before. And B, there's two different types of critical filmmakers. One is someone who likes to pick apart and give us a chance to examine everything. Every little part of ideology with like a, you know, like sort of a fine tooth comb. And I guess you could say something like, you know, Godard's Tout va bien is that type of film. And then there's the critical filmmaker who just sees their subject and just takes a fucking hatchet to them. And that is The Exterminating Angel. Because I love the way that it just like completely leans into the fact that the rich are morons. The rich are just fucking idiots.
Rich are so stupid.
And of course, it is. Well, they get stupider, right? Without their servants, they descend into like, you know, like I'm very critical of Adorno's essay on occultism, but he does. It does describe what happens. They almost turn into a cult. At one point, they're going to sacrifice their host for the evening, thinking that he's like the wizard that has caused them to be trapped.
Absolutely.
Would they get like stuck in a room at one point? I remember that was hilarious. Oh my God.
Oh God, yeah. And like different factions develop. Some of them are like trying to conspire against each other. And then you realize all of this just takes place over the course of like one night. It's like one single night, isn't it?
One single night. And one of the things that's so brilliant about it, I mean, as Marxists, we say that classes only exist in social relation, right? And mm-hmm. these people are just deprived of the working class for one fucking night.
And they descend into just utter, just yeah. blithering idiocy.
Yeah, they, yeah. I mean, some of them just want to get high. They're looking for the opium. Other, you know, like, the and the mysterious force sends the sheep in. God, you know, yes. like, which, of course, gets quoted in my favorite Godard film, Weekend. Well, maybe my second favorite, La Chemin, is probably my favorite. But anyway,
but
it's that dialectic again of the imaginary projection that you get,
yes.
you know, with automatic drawing, with the dream image, but mm-hmm. in relationship mm-hmm. to and in critique of realism, which is actually just capitalism's story about itself.
Yes, right? Exactly.
And that's
exactly,
the dialectic yeah. interplay you get either like consciously, quite obviously, mostly consciously with Buñuel's Exterminating Angel, and of course Pasolini's Hawks and Sparrows, possibly not totally conscious in Max Ernst's A Week of Kindness. Max Ernst went to a lot of orgies. I don't know if he was straight or not, you know, like, so he's asking questions about like gender norms and sexuality here that wouldn't have a language to articulate them. You know, for a while. Well, there was a partial language that was being developed. Of course, Max Ernst was German, so he would have been familiar with the gay rights movement was the largest in Berlin, was the largest in the world before Hitler.
That was why I brought up the Wright book, why I brought up Native Son, because it is that sort of like the primacy of the expression of the mind without fetters, but then it comes up against that, it comes up against the actual reality, ideological and material, of how capitalism actually treats human beings. I am convinced, not just tempted, but straight up convinced to look at that Ernst work as gender critical. And I think that I think one of the problems with the state of the left right now is that there are large parts of the left, and they tend to overlap in many ways with this sort of like hyper-rational parts of the left that we polemicize against quite a bit. But they tend to conflate representation with endorsement. And this gets to everything that, like, say, Adam, I know that you and Anupam have spoken about with the impossibility of representation. There is a way in which a simple representation of violence or gender oppression or racial oppression doesn't serve in the same sort of revelatory way it did, say, like around the time of the Rodney King verdict. Nonetheless, there is a tendency, and, you know, that should have an impact on how artists and writers move forward in their task, their critical task. That should be taken into consideration. We would be actually pretty dogmatic and I think kind of stodgy to not admit to that. But nonetheless, to look back on the Ernst work and say, like, that, oh no, this is just straight up misogyny. That dehistoricizes everything. Whereas everything you just did is actually historicizing it and looking at it through that lens of, well, the natural affinity between communist revolution and the abolition of gender roles.
The abolition of enforced gender roles.
Enforced gender roles, right. Exactly, yeah.
Well, the young comrades are, of course, right that there's no excuse for racism or heterosexism or ever. Mm-hmm. You can't say that was the time. There is sure. But to fully understand oppression, you have to understand, you have to have a non-president, you have to historicize.
This is the end of part one of our discussion. Part two is being held ransom by a machine entity whose masters no longer remember how to control it. To liberate it and get a second hour of Locust Radio, go to patreon.com/locustreview. and subscribe for $5 a month or more. Locust Radio is hosted by Tish Turrell, Adam Turrell, and Alexander Billett. It's produced by Drew Franzblau, that's me. Our music is by Omnia Soul.